Is this on? I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. It's really nice to see you all. I spent the week really enjoying the sound of your footsteps. I set up a little corner in my little COVID kuti, and every time that I heard you galloping towards the gym to eat, I would find myself going and sitting down on my cushions just to actually hear your footsteps in my body. I felt really supported by that, like I was leaning into sound. It made me think of a memory I had, which is actually my first memory, which was listening to the sounds of my mother. And it made me wonder, is this a natural alignment that we have, actually, to lean into things, this kind of intimacy? After all, our birth is a cry into the world, felt in the heart of a mother. This is a visceral sound, something galvanizing, something up close. So COVID has been a very interesting teacher, this session. A strong teacher. A good reminder that the Dharma is not for the faint of heart. It's a bit shocking to see that there is no stable ground so vividly. Sometimes you have to flee a monastery. Sometimes that's the wise thing to do. And the paradox of practice life has been made so vivid. Although we set up all these conditions for moving together, just one tickle in your throat and you're alone. No one else swallows your phlegm, experiences your aching chest, your sore body, your fever. No one can experience your particular flavor of heartbreak. And although we are moved to care for each other, express our compassion, we wisely put on a face mask. On the other hand, kindness is noticed. It has force. And there is so much balm in a breath of fresh air. In the sight of a cherry blossom tree, in a cup of tea on a sore throat, we are being supported in countless ways. And that's why we practice, so we can keep our eyes and ears open. Since there's been a lot of attention in my chest area for the last week, I wanted to talk about the heart. I'd like to share This poem is called Small Kindnesses. It's written by the poet Danusha Lamaris. It goes like this. I've been thinking about the way when you walk down a crowded aisle, people pull in their legs to let you by. Or how strangers still say, bless you, when someone sneezes. A leftover from the bubonic plague. Don't die, we are saying. And sometimes when you spill lemons from your grocery bag, someone else will help you pick them up. Mostly, we don't want to harm each other. We wanted to be handed our cup of coffee hot and to say thank you to the person handing it, to smile at them and for them to smile back, for the waitress to call us honey when she sets down the bowl of clam chowder and for the driver in the red pickup truck to let us pass. We have so little of each other now, so far from tribe and fire, only these brief moments of exchange. What if they are the true dwelling of the holy, these fleeting temples we make together when we say, here, have my seat. Go ahead, you first. I like your hat. The Zen tradition highlights the importance of these intimate encounters between people, our ability to notice things, to be touched, to have the heart stirred, and how words can get in the way of that. We've probably all heard of the famous episode that occurred on Vulture's Peak, the defining moment for the Chan and Zen tradition. It goes like this. Once when the World Honored One in ancient times was upon Vulture's Peak, he held up a flower before the assembly of monks. At this, all were silent. The venerable Kashyapa alone broke into a smile. The world-honored one said, I have the all-pervading eye of the true Dharma, the secret heart of incomparable nirvana, the true aspect of formless form. It does not rely on letters and is transmitted outside the sutras. I now hand it on to Mahakashyapa. The Denkuroku is a collection of koans compiled by the Japanese Zen master Keizan, who is the Dharma heir of Dogen. And it describes enlightenment accounts of each of the 52 or so earliest masters. It says that Kashyapa was born into an Indian Brahmin family. And as a monk, he was renowned for his ascetic self-discipline and moral strictness. These were qualities that actually allowed him to assume the leadership of the Sangha after the death of the Buddha. It was Kashyapa who convened the first Buddhist council, which was held to counteract tendencies towards a less strict lifestyle within the Sangha. According to this story, he had differences of opinion with Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, but in the end authorized him as his Dharma heir in Zen's ancestral line. And you can see their relationship reflected in the lineage chant that we do here. The influence of this moment, this intimate exchange between Buddha, Mahakashyapa, a flower, and a smile, is said to have initiated the mind-to-mind transmission of Zen. Maybe it's not a matter of what the Buddha did or didn't do that moment on Vulture's Peak. Whether he held up a flower or an old shoe, does it matter? Maybe it's more a matter of his being and Kashyapa's seeing. In this way, we can consider practice as developing a sensitivity of the heart. One of the things that I really missed being alone in my little kuti was this practice actually of bowing together, pressing hands together at the heart. I missed doing this in gratitude to the ancestors in service. I missed sharing in the heartache of the folks on the dedication list. And I missed simply crossing by each of you as we move through the monastery, acknowledging each other, human beings, giving their best. Outside the monastery, we may not acknowledge our effect on each other so much, how we inter are, how placing your palms together at your heart is cultivating, a mysterious cultivation. So I actually found myself doing that in my room, in relationship to my teacup, my food, my bed, my snotty tissues. A kind of carrying practice, something I can take away from the monastery. Really, everything is worthy of being bowed to. Like Thich Nhat Hanh says, in every step, a flower blooms, or not, our choice. The heart's been on my mind a lot recently because my mother was just admitted into the cardiac ICU about a month ago. Her heart was failing her, and so she was strapped up to various machines, and then they decided to implant a pacemaker. This particular hospital was a teaching hospital, and so I got the opportunity to listen to the cardiac surgeon as he discoursed on the problems of the heart. He was very chatty and talkative, and he would go from one room to the next with his students discussing each case. So according to him, hearts stop doing their thing because of three problems. Firstly, not enough charge. So they stop beating strongly enough. That's the problem with my mother's heart. Very low heart rate. Or they're blocked up. The plumbing is not working. This requires various kinds of surgeries, stents, bypasses. Lastly, they are damaged. This is harder to solve. The heart needs to be replaced altogether. And for some elderly people, this is just not possible. They're just too old. Life is over. In fact, he made the point that with medicine being so good, they're in a strange situation where they just have to watch really old people have their heart just peter out. A new problem. As I spent time in the ICU, I noticed this funny thing happening with my own heart. The tenderness, this sense of vulnerability. Everyone who was moving around in that atmosphere was aware of the fragility of existence. Their loved one was in a bad way. And we visitors became very tender to each other, very careful, because the preciousness of life was so vivid and the impact of kindness so clear. It's actually funny with humans. Often we seem to be able to deal with extreme situations easier than just ordinary times. Of course, this study of the heart is obviously not just of interest to cardiac surgeons, but is the real terrain of spiritual life. There's a great value in exploring the fragility of things before we're pushed up by the circumstances of our life. And I applaud that you are doing that so diligently for so many days. When we do this, we're not so thrown when our best laid plans are extinguished by one clogged artery, one exploding vein, by our relationship ending, by our child struggling, by death, by boredom, by a nasty COVID bug, by the numerous ways our hopes and dreams can get shattered. I think we have a common fascination with impermanence, or we wouldn't be here. I think we're all really curious about this shifting, ungraspable, unfathomable life. And there's a great value in honoring the limitations in our heart area, in noticing our inability to love, to appreciate things fully. What is the gift in our most blocked spaces? What's calling to be looked at? We wouldn't be here if we didn't aspire to love well. As you've attended to sound so diligently for so many days, you've probably begun to hear the notes of some unfamiliar songs. There's a wonderful image of the Hindu god Krishna blowing the sound of breath through his flute. This melody is so captivating and compelling that people throw away their lives for it. They become disoriented, disarmed. They can't understand the tune. But having fallen in love, they trust it's important. Spiritual life is like that. We surrender to the tune of the heart. Today I want to revisit a text that was emphasized last year for Ango here at ZCAO. called the Diamond Sutra. Diamond Sutra is one of the essential Mahayana texts and part of the Prajna Paramita literature. I'm just going to focus on the first few paragraphs of this text because they really highlight the heart space, the ability to notice things, the importance of these intimate exchanges in the teachings. When we begin to notice this connected life, it's also a wonderful text for bringing practice into the everyday. If we're leaving the monastery, we really need to be clear on the point of why we are doing Sesshin. What are the implications of this practice for the beings in our life at home? And these first paragraphs have some very inspiring suggestions. How to view one's ordinary life, ordinary activities, as the sparkling diamond. Goes like this. This is from the translation by Red Pine. I think the text that was studied here before was by Stephen Mitchell. Thus have I heard. Once the Bhagavan was dwelling near Shravasti at Anathapindika's garden in the Jeta forest, together with the full assembly of 1,250 bhikshus and a great many fearless bodhisattvas. That's a lot. So Anathapindika, if you don't know, is the Buddha's chief male patron. His chief female patron is named Visakha. Anathapindika means one who gives alms to the unprotected, who is supposed to be very generous, especially to those in need. And he was a wealthy businessman living in Savatthi or Shravasti. They're one's Pali, one's Sanskrit. And this is a town in the southern foothills of the Himalayas in Uttar Pradesh. Savatthi is the capital of the kingdom of Kosala, the ancient kingdom. And this is the place where the Buddha lived most of his life after enlightenment. This very famous monastery, Jetavana Monastery, is referred to in many, many sermons throughout Buddhist literature. And this is where this is also taking place. It says, one day before noon, the Bhagavan put on his patched robe, picked up his bowl, and entered the capital of Shravasti for food offerings. After begging for food in the city and eating his meal of rice, he returned from his daily round in the afternoon, put his robe and bowl away, washed his feet, and sat down on the appointed seat. After crossing his legs and adjusting his body, he turned his awareness to what was before him. This is such an ordinary paragraph, really. And I find it so fascinating because, so the title of the Diamond Sutra is, in Sanskrit, is the Vajra Chedaka Prajna Paramita Sutra, which is translated as, a Vajra is not just a diamond, but it's a legendary and ritualistic weapon, which has both the qualities of a thunderbolt and a diamond. So it's a very powerful, solid thing. It's cutting and it's luminous. And so it's this very big title, and then it starts off with this very ordinary paragraph. After begging for food in the city and eating his meal of rice, he returned from his daily round in the afternoon, put his robe and bowl away, washed his feet, and sat down on the appointed seat. After crossing his legs and adjusting his body, he turned his awareness to what was before him. We may say, I woke up, brushed my teeth, had a coffee, took a shower, got to work. This is a wonderful description of an ordinary day in the life of a great being. This great being doing such ordinary things. The diamond that is right here, not in some special cave. In the early Buddhist tradition, the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis are supported by the lay community. They eat what is offered, and they eat before noon. So here, the Buddha is being described going on his alms round, returning in the afternoon, because he's been discoursing and teaching. It's a means of appreciating the food offering. This reciprocal relationship of food for teachings has sustained the Dharma for thousands of years for our benefit today. It's interesting to think that with this rule, the Buddha kept the monastic community connected to the lay community. They couldn't just run away and meditate in a cave somewhere. This is actually very radical for that time. We may consider, what are the simple rhythms that sustain our lives? The things that we commit to, the connections that we maintain. How do we value that kind of motion? Sometimes we don't even notice what's very ordinary. The textures of our everyday life, because they've become so mundane. This is one of the gifts of Sesshin, that you can appreciate your life. Then he put his robe and bowl away, washed his feet, and sat down on the appointed seat, crossed his legs, adjusted his body, and turned his awareness to what was before him. This is a beautiful and comprehensive description of mindfulness practice. He put his robe and bowl away, washed his feet. How do you care for the things that care for you? The robe and bowl are considered to be the two most important possessions of a monk or nun. What's your robe and bowl? He washed his feet. The Buddha and his disciples did not have shoes, so they had to clean their feet from the dust from the road before taking the teacher's seat. How do we enter into things? What's our state of preparation? He crossed his legs and adjusted his body. How do you feel alignment, and how do you adjust? Are these different things? Are they oppositional? Can we include discomfort in the flow of things? This is something to test out on your cushion. He sat down on the appointed seat. Apparently, the seat that was often taken was made out of kusha grass, a kind of long, soft grass that would be put on the ground to be made comfortable, or a small stool. This is interesting, the idea of an appointed seat. Do we have an argument with life? Do we accept what's obvious to take up? Who's making the choice? He turned his awareness to what was before him. That's just like what you've been doing all week. Why is this so difficult? Where are we usually? According to the Buddha, we are completely tangled in me and mine thought threads. There's this delightful word called prapancha, which is the nature of the mind to proliferate. Now, it's actually a word that's used in the artistic tradition as well, this idea of being storytellers, elaborating, adding layers, being creative. The mind is wonderful, it's magical. But we need to know how to use it and not be used by it. Some commentators have looked at this very short paragraph and noticed that it's a way of describing the six paramitas. And I'm going to mention it because it's actually quite beautiful. So the six paramitas, the first one is shanti. Shanti is a word with a lot of translations: patience, tolerance, forbearance, endurance, acceptance. So they think that this expression of the Buddha going for the alms round demonstrates this paramita. His monk's robe demonstrates the paramita sila, which is discipline, morality, virtue, proper conduct. His begging bowl represents dana, the expression of generosity, giving. All the activities of eating his meal, returning to his abode, putting away his robe and bowl, washing his feet, are expressions of virya, vigor, energy, diligence. And then turning his attention to what is before him is the expression of dhyana, meditation, concentration, contemplation. And then the sixth is prajna, wisdom. He does all of these things, all of these expressions, activities, without being attached. how can we view our very mundane activities in this kind of a light, as expressions of perfection, as opportunities to develop the paramitas? The text goes on and describes this very famous person who is so touched by what he sees. His name is Saputi. It goes like this. On this occasion, the Venerable Saputi was also present in the assembly. Rising from his seat, he uncovered one shoulder and touched his right knee to the ground. Pressing his palms together and bowing to the Buddha, he said, "It is rare, Bhagavan, most rare indeed, Sugata, how the Tathagata, the Arahant, the fully enlightened one, blesses fearless bodhisattvas with the best of blessings. And it is rare, Bhagavan, how the Tathagata, the Arahant, the fully enlightened one, entrusts fearless bodhisattvas with the greatest of trust." I love this description of the bare-shouldered Saputi spilling his heart out. It's such a heartfelt statement. He notices the Buddha's ability to love, to care, to nurture others, to trust. And it moves him. He speaks that out loud. We can be deeply moved by things, but do we have the guts to actually say that? There's something powerful in Saputi's articulation of his appreciation. This is also a really wise statement about the qualities of a teacher. One who can bless, meaning share the wisdom of their experience, but also trust, let go, and allow the particular flavor of the student to emerge. This made me really want to know, who is Saputi? Of course, there's many versions of the story. According to the Theravadan tradition, Saputi was born into a wealthy family and was a relative of Anathapindika, the chief patron of the Buddha that I just mentioned. In this version of the story, he became a monk after hearing the Buddha teach at the dedication ceremony of Jetavana Monastery, this big monastery. Apparently, after ordaining, Saputi went into the forest and became an arhant while meditating on loving kindness, metta. And it said that due to his mastery of loving kindness meditation, any gift offered to him bore the greatest merit for the donor, thus earning him the title of foremost in being worthy of gifts. Saputi plays a much larger role in Mahayana Buddhism. He's said to be the disciple foremost in the understanding of emptiness. And he's a central figure in the Prajnaparamita texts. It's quite funny because in contrast to the Theravadan tradition, the Mahayana sutras describe him as grumpy. And there's a famous episode from the Diamond Sutra that's also found in the koan literature about Saputi. You can sort of get the flavor of the grumpiness. So it describes the god Chakra, so Indra is another name for Chakra, appearing before him and scattering flowers. Saputi asks, "Why are you doing this?" Chakra says he is making offerings to thank Saputi for teaching him about prajna. And Saputi replies, "But I have not said one word. How can you say I teach prajna? To this, Chakra replies, so it is. The Venerable Subhuti does not teach, and I do not hear any dharma, nothing taught and nothing heard. This is true prajna. Regardless of whether Subhuti was kind or grumpy, he asked this very good question. Even so, Bhagavan, if a noble son or daughter should set forth on the bodhisattva path, how should they stand? How should they walk? And how should they control their thoughts? I mean, imagine this. He gets this chance to stand up in front of the Buddha. We know he is an incredibly wise and insightful person. You'd think he might try to be smart, to say something impressive, some kind of complicated question. But no, keeps it really simple. He sees that the teachings are about basic things. How do you stand? How do you walk? How do you deal with this crazy mind? And the Buddha is impressed with this answer. I'm sorry, with this question. He says, well said, Subhuti, well said. So it is, Subhuti, it is as you say. I shall tell you how those who set forth on the bodhisattva path should stand, how they should walk, and how they should control their thoughts. The Buddha says, Subhuti, those who would now set forth on the bodhisattva path should thus give birth to this thought. However many beings there are, in whatever realms of being might exist, I shall liberate them all. Wow, that's an amazing aspiration. What kind of confidence is necessary to make a statement like that? And then he throws in this confounding statement. Though I liberate countless beings, not a single being is liberated. And why not, Subhuti? A bodhisattva who creates the perception of a being cannot be called a bodhisattva. Sometimes I think that due to the popularity of secular mindfulness, we can get confused about what we're actually doing in practice. Although it's a wonderful thing to do things mindfully, to fully do things, to reap the joy and power in that, that's not the point of Dharma practice. The point of Dharma practice is to root out this mistaken view of who we are and how we exist. In the second discourse that the Buddha gave, called the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the Sutta on No Self, he highlights three simple statements that are responsible for our suffering, the fundamental ignorance. This is mine. This I am. This is myself. The teaching is that if we pay attention to the impermanence of the five aggregates, forms, feelings, sensations, perceptions, and consciousness, as you've been doing for all these days, we'll see that there is nothing essential. And then there'll be this interesting statement that might come forth. This is not mine. This I am not. this is not myself. He goes on, moreover, Sabuti, when bodhisattvas give a gift, they should not be attached to a thing. When they give a gift, they should not be attached to anything at all. And why, Sabuti? The body of merit of those bodhisattvas who give a gift without being attached is not easy to measure. Why would you curtail the breath of your generosity? What are the ways that we limit things? Do we experience our lives in a broad way? Do we experience others in a broad way? Do we really know where we begin and end? Who's stirring this heart? Who's steering this ship? When we pay attention, we notice that we are always in exchange. Breath is moving in and out of the body, light coming into the eyes and out of the eyes, objects moving in front of our vision, ceaseless appearing and disappearing of sounds. There's this giving and taking all day long, the natural course of things. Gift-giving is an ongoing activity. It's the actual engine of our aliveness. And we're being bowed to time and time again. Can we notice? The Dharma teaches that it is from connection and not separation that true generosity flows forth. So we're told that Sabuti was drawn to the Buddhist path, maybe through his aptitude for kindness, or maybe through his aptitude for irritation. We don't know. But we do know that he had a heart that could be stirred by beauty, that he was touched by seeing kindness. And he had the courage to ask a simple question that has resounded through the centuries, a question which brought forth the potential in his own fragile body. How do I stand? How do I walk? How do I control my thoughts? Isn't it wonderful that this is the very same question we've been pondering this week? We are bonded throughout time by the fragility of our lives, the fragility of our hearts. We are in loving community through the facts of sickness, old age, and death. And we got such a direct experience of this truth on this session. I hope that this week of deep listening keeps your heart lit. And that the challenges that you faced, you use as kindling for the fire of your aspiration. I wanted to end with this poem by the Palestinian American poet Naomi Shoaib Nye called Red Brocade. The Arabs used to say, when a stranger appears at your door, feed him for 3 days before asking who he is, where he's come from, where he's headed. That way, he'll have strength enough to answer. Or by then, you'll be such good friends, you don't care. Let's go back to that. Rice? Pine nuts? Here, take the red brocade pillow. My child will serve water to your horse. No, I was not busy when you came. I was not preparing to be busy. That's the armor everyone put on to pretend they had a purpose in the world. I refuse to be claimed. Your plate is waiting. We will snip fresh mint into your tea. May you always keep your door open.